I grew up hearing all about them, how they were sticking it to us, how they had raised the price of food, gas, clothing, and everything else, while our wages remained low. So low that my family and many of those who I grew up with had to have two incomes coming in just to make ends meet. My father worked 40 hours a week as a truck driver for a bottle exchange, and my mom a clerk for the Department of Defense. Every winter, my dad went hunting to supplement our supply of meat in the freezer. And in the summer, he and I would go fishing at the mouth of the harbor to stock up on fish. In the fall, my mom made pickles and canned vegetables from our garden, and we all picked berries to make jam. Although I found none of this unpleasant, and I learned many life skills from how we lived, I experienced the effects of what an unfair world had done to my parents, and possibly to their parents before them, in other much less enjoyable ways. And when I grew older and faced my own life challenges, bumping into or banging face first into the restrictions of prejudice, I experienced firsthand how all things aren't created equal in this world. It's highly unlikely that there was or has ever been, since the days of Robin Hood, an organized conspiracy to rob from the poor. But the feeling that these infamous others had more control over our lives than we did was very real. And so they became the collective word for all those who held that power. They were the politicians. They were the government, the lawmakers, the tax people, the bosses, and the managing middle class. They were anyone in authority who made decisions that affected our lives without so much as asking us what we wanted or how much we could manage to give. They were those who we resented for the power that they held over us and for the privileges that they had and we didn't. They were the ones who profited by the rules that they helped create, and we only seemed to suffer because of them. And in our minds, they cared only about protecting what they had and very little about any of us. We were the nobodies. Every one of us, at one time or another, has known what it's like to have been made to feel less than. It's an awful feeling, and yet, instead of rejecting this system that allows this to happen, we buy into it and seek out ways to improve our status, to up our rank so that we are heard and that we get more respect. We feel better about ourselves when we are treated better by others. And when we advance in rank, we are rewarded with money, prestige, power, and privilege. It's no wonder that when we get there, we have to struggle not to believe that we are actually better than those we left behind. Each of us have at our core a belief that we are just as worthy as the next person. But few of us can maintain that sense of dignity without a fight when faced with a world continually telling us something different. It's a common belief that the best will rise to the top of the heap. So what does this say about those who are still struggling to climb their way up or have given up trying altogether? Every time I see one of those rags-to-riches stories, when someone beats all odds, I inwardly cringe, and I wonder, who are these people, and what superhuman abilities have they been given to rise above what keeps the majority of us in our place? Instead of feeling motivated, as is the intention of these stories, I feel ashamed, and I question, what is wrong with me that no matter how hard I try, I can't seem to get the same results? Aside from the fact that we don't all start in the same place, not everyone is able to advance their rank of privilege. Not everyone can aspire to be a upper middle class, white, young, thin, able-bodied, attractive, straight, cisgendered American male. Some of us carry our disadvantages with us our entire lives, while others experience such things only at stages, like when we are old or in between jobs. Some of us carry more than others, a burden multiplying with each marginalization we experience. But still, we all do the best we can to fit into a system that seems bent on putting labels and dividing us into a hierarchy of credibility and importance. It's difficult not to sound disparaging when talking about how some people have privilege and others don't, especially when much of it is based on such arbitrary criteria as the color of our skin, our gender, or economic status. It's hard not to think that all those who have such advantages aren't willing to share them, or to think that poor folks make bad decisions and aren't very forward-thinking because, well, if they were, they'd be better off. There's no doubt that privilege divides us in many ways, but I think how it divides us the most is our lack of understanding about where the other is coming from and the assumptions that we make from those limited perspectives. It's an accepted belief that our experience shapes who we are, but those experiences also shape how we see ourselves in this world and what we expect from it. Given the opportunity, any one of us might make the same poor or self-serving choices that the other is making, if only we had the fortune or misfortune to be living their lives. Not long ago, I read an article called "How Well-Intentioned White Families Can Perpetuate Racism," where the author, Joe Pinsker, was interviewing a sociologist named Margaret Hagerman, who, after spending 2 years talking to and observing upper-middle-class white families, wrote a book called "White Kids Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America." The article spoke about how otherwise progressive-minded folks with status and economic resources can set up their children's lives in ways that give them the best education, the best health care, and all the best that their money and status can have to offer. And in doing so, inadvertently promote radical inequality and the idea that some are more entitled than others. It went on to say that white parents talking about race with their children does matter, but that the choices they make about what types of people their children encounter every day, what neighborhood they live in, and what schools they go to, and even who they carpool with, might matter even more, especially if you are wanting to promote the idea that diversity and pluralisms are good things to have. Pluralism. Taking care of our children and providing for them is, of course, an admirable thing to do, something all parents try to do to the best of their ability. One can just imagine the parents of the kids in the more affluent neighborhoods complaining to the school board if their kids don't have the very best gym equipment or math teacher available. But in the poorer neighborhoods, not so much. Many parents who grew up themselves in a having-to-make-do environment have learned to accept that their lot in life and aren't used to the idea that they can demand something better for their children. In fact, where I come from, it wasn't unheard of that a parent interested in only preparing their child for the life in front of them might even try to dissuade them from dreaming about their future, as entertaining such lofty thoughts would only hurt them in the end. Already at this early stage of life, the idea that some are more worthy than others is being instilled in these kids' heads. And those from the more affluent neighborhoods believing that they deserve all they have, and those in the poorer neighborhoods being told that they deserve much less. The us and them division is clearly being defined despite any good things the parents might be trying to teach. In 1968, after the assassination of Martin Luther King, an Iowan teacher named Jane Elliott enacted an exercise to teach her grade 3 class about racism. She separated her students according to their eye color and told them that those with brown eyes were better and more intelligent than those with blue eyes. Blue-eyed people sit around and do nothing, she told them. You give them something nice and they just wreck it. As the morning progressed, the brown-eyed kids began to berate their blue-eyed classmates. Well, what do you expect from him, Mrs. Elliott? A brown-eyed student said, as a blue-eyed one got an arithmetic problem wrong. He's a bluey. A blue-eyed girl who never had problems with multiplication before began making mistakes. And at recess, three brown-eyed girls ganged up on her. You better apologize to us for getting in our way because we're better than you are, one of the brownies said. The blue-eyed girl apologized. What I find fascinating about this exercise is how simply telling someone what is expected of them has such a profound effect on their behavior, and how those that were expected less of thought less of themselves, and so had less to give. And how the sense of entitlement and superiority increased with those who were given more advantages. You might think, well, they were only kids after all, but 24 years later, during an Oprah Winfrey show, the exercise was recreated, and the adults didn't fare any better. They were just as nasty. What makes people behave this way, I don't know. But I do think that the structure of our society allows for it and even encourages it with its everyone for themselves attitude. Back in Iowa, when the exercise ended, Mrs. Elliott asked her students to write down what they learned from the exercise. One girl wrote, "The people in Mrs. Elliott's room who had brown eyes got to discriminate against the people who had blue eyes. I have brown eyes. I felt like hitting them if I wanted to. I got to have 5 minutes extra of recess." And then the next day when the tables were turned, "I felt like quitting school. I felt mad. That's what it felt like when you're discriminated against." She felt mad and she wanted to quit. And that was just after one day. Now imagine what it's like for someone who grows up with discrimination, who lives with it every day, seeing how those others have it so much easier because of how the world is arranged. For a better part of my life, I've felt angry too. And that anger sustained me in a world that kept telling me that I wasn't good enough. It protected my sense of self, telling me whenever I needed it that I deserved the same respect as anyone else and that those who didn't allow me the same opportunities because of my differences were just plain wrong. I see a lot of this type of anger at our place, a nonprofit here in Victoria that serves the street community. The type of anger that erupts out of the indignity of being treated as less than, and in their case, having to exist at the bottom of the heap, like discarded garbage. A while ago, I was sitting with a fellow, and he asked me what my work as a spiritual care volunteer entailed. So I told him a bit about what I do. He then proceeded to tell me what his job was. "My job," he said, "is to be downtrodden and beaten so that you have something to come to work for." Touché, I thought. I definitely felt put in my place, and I told him so. He replied that it wasn't his intention to do that, and I acknowledged it, saying, "I know, it's the system, isn't it?" And he nodded. At our place, I happen to be one of the privileged, even though I don't have any difficulty with meeting each person there as my equal or potential teacher. Much of what I take for granted in my life and I see as my right to have, they see as luxury and privilege. And by the grace of that privilege, I get to put myself in the position where it's taken for granted that I am the one who's doing the giving and that I am the smarter and better able person. It's not fair. It's not right. Quite a few of those who I meet at our place talk about things that are intellectually above my understanding. And I certainly enjoy many a philosophical conversation with those who our society considers unworthy, just as I had been doing with that homeless man who I was now sitting with. And so, as I sat there in the silence that followed, I felt that old anger rising up inside of me, and then a heavy sadness because I couldn't tell him that I wouldn't do something about this unfairness. I felt powerless despite the position of privilege I was in. And with that realization came the thought that maybe many of those who I see in their positions of privilege might also feel just as powerless. The system we've created seems to have taken on a life of its own, and in my opinion, has grown into a monster. For days after I walked around in a funk, I thought, what is the point of even trying? There's nothing that can be done. We are all doomed. Our world is going to hell in a handbasket, and there's nothing that any of us can do to stop it. And then I heard Reverend Shauna's sermon, Open and Willing, where she offered the reading that we shared in open words here today. And my hope was renewed. Reverend Shauna's sermon reminded me that nothing is as permanent as we tend to think it is, that we can change our world by becoming the change that we want to see. And maybe others will be inspired to do the same if we live large and connect with more people. The only question that remains then is, what should we actually do? Now, here's the part where you might be expecting me to begin listing off the things that I think we need to be doing. But I'm not going to do that because, well, to be honest, I don't really know. I'm only one person with one vantage point, and I can't help but remember how my opinion changed after the above-mentioned conversation. So I'm hesitant to offer solutions from such a limited perspective, one that more than likely will change again tomorrow if I happen to have such a conversation with another. One thing I can tell you for certain is that if I hadn't been open to hearing what that homeless fellow had to say, if I had never been willing to sit with his pain and my discomfort and examine them both, I would never have come to the understanding that I had. As a spiritual care volunteer, it is my job to listen without pushing my own agenda. The premise is that such listening lets others know that you believe them worthy of your attention. It's meant to be a simple gift of compassion and healing. But for me, the act has become a spiritual practice as well. One where my willingness to be changed by what I hear, even from those who speak to me in anger, has taught me that everyone is worth listening to, and that how they express themselves is part of what I need to hear. There's been a lot said about how we need to change the ways we communicate, using I statements and taking care not to shame or blame. But if I demanded the same from one of those who I reach out to at our place, I have no doubt that they'd walk away in disgust, thinking here yet again was someone only interested in shutting them up. It's all very well and good to take responsibility for what we say, but I also think there's much to be gained if we allow others to the chance to freely express how it hurts, without the added responsibility of their having to care for us as well. And especially when we are in a privileged position of not having experienced what they have suffered, which, when you think about it, pretty much includes everyone. So I've been wondering if I shouldn't try to continue my spiritual practice of compassionate listening in my day-to-day life as well. It would be difficult, but imagine how much I can learn if I listened to what others had to say without expecting anything more from them than their honest sharing. And what if we did this all together? I'm going out on an idealistic limb here with this, but can you imagine the collective knowledge we'd gain? Perhaps the best place to start in our effort to change a system that doesn't recognize the inherent worth and dignity of every person is to actually grant that dignity to each other by listening with care to how the system has let each of us down. And without our taking offense to how that pain is expressed. Then, as the barriers of misunderstanding between us dissolve, so might our divisions, and we'd have a much clearer idea about how to fix what is broken in our world, with all of us working together as one for the common good. You know, I can't help but think about what John Lennon said. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be as one. Thank you for listening to my dream.